Welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. It is Friday, March 22. We have some inclement weather out there. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. And our first story today from the Globe Gazette, headline is Justice Department Sues Apple. And there's another part of that says prosecutors allege it illegally monopolized smartphone market. This is written by Michael Lidke, Lindsay Whitehurst, Frank Bajak, and Mike Balsamo, Associated Press, Dateline Washington, and it reads, the Justice Department announced a sweeping antitrust lawsuit Thursday against Apple, accusing the tech giant of engineering an illegal monopoly in smartphones that boxes out competitors, stifles innovation, and keeps prices artificially high. The lawsuit, filed in federal court in New Jersey, alleges that Apple has monopoly power in the smartphone market and leverages control over the iPhone to, quote, engage in a broad, sustained, and illegal course of conduct. Apple has locked its consumers into the iPhone while locking its competitors out of the market, end quote, said Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco. Stalling the advancement of the very market it revolutionized, she said, it has smothered an entire industry. Apple called the lawsuit, quote, wrong on the facts and the law, and said it will vigorously defend against it. The suit takes aim at how Apple allegedly molds its technology and business relationships to extract more money from consumers, developers, content creators, artists, publishers, small businesses, and merchants, among others, end quote. That includes diminishing the functionality of non-Apple smartwatches, limiting access to contactless payment for third-party digital wallets, and refusing to allow its iMessage app to exchange encrypted messaging with competing platforms. It specifically seeks to stop Apple from undermining technologies that compete with its own apps in areas including streaming, messaging, and digital payments, and prevent it from continuing to craft contracts with developers, accessory makers, and consumers that let it, quote, obtain, maintain, extend, or entrench a monopoly, end quote. The lawsuit filed with 16 state attorneys general is just the latest example of aggressive antitrust enforcement by an administration that has also taken on Google, Amazon, and other tech giants with the stated aim of making the digital universe more fair, innovative, and competitive. The Department of Justice has an enduring legacy taking on the biggest and toughest monopolies in history, said Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Cantor, head of the Antitrust Division, at a press conference announcing the lawsuit. He continued, today we stand here once again to promote competition and innovation for next generation of technology. Antitrust researcher Dina Srivanathan, a Yale University fellow, compared the lawsuit's significance to the government's action against Microsoft a quarter century ago, picking a tremendous fight with what has been the world's most prosperous company. It's a really big deal to go up and punch someone who is acting like a bully and pretending not to be a bully, she said. President Joe Biden has called for the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission to vigorously enforce antitrust statutes, while it stepped up policing of corporate mergers and questionable business practices met resistance from some business leaders, accusing the Democratic administration of overreach. It's been lauded by others as long overdue. The case seeks to pierce the digital fortress that Apple Incorporated, based in Cupertino, California, carefully built around the iPhone and other popular products such as the iPad, Mac, and Apple Watch to create what it is often referred to as a, in quotes, walled garden. So its hardware and software can seamlessly offer user-friendly harmony. The strategy helped Apple attain an annual revenue of almost $400 billion and, until recently, a market value of more than $3 trillion. But Apple's shares fell by 7% this year, even as most of the stock market climbed to new highs, resulting in longtime rival Microsoft seizing the mantle as the world's most valuable company. Apple said the lawsuit, if successful, would, quote, hinder our ability to create the kind of technology people expect from Apple, where hardware, software, and services intersect, and would set a dangerous precedent, empowering government to take a heavy hand in designing people's technology, end quote. Apple has defended the walled garden as an indispensable feature prized by consumers who want the best protection available for their personal information. Quote, Apple claims to be a champion of protecting user data, but its App Store fee structure and partnership with Google's search erode privacy, end quote, Consumer Reports senior researcher Sumit Sharma said in a statement. The lawsuit complains that Apple charges as much as $1,599 for an iPhone and that the high margins it earns on each is more than double what others in the industry get. When users run an internet search, Google gives Apple a significant cut of the advertising revenue those searches generate. The company's App Store also charges developers up to 30% of the app's price for consumers. Consumers should not have to pay higher prices because companies break the law, said Attorney General Merrick Garland. Left unchallenged, Apple would only continue to strengthen its smartphone monopoly, he added. But don't expect a verdict until 2026, which means the case could easily drag on with appeals. Our second story on today's front page, landslide risk grows as climate change worsens storms, wildfires. Also, OSO tragedy 10 years ago became wake-up call for efforts to address danger. This is an Associated Press article written by Gene Johnson and Becky Bohler, B-O-H-R-E-R. OSO Washington, OSO. After the mountainside collapsed, obliterating a neighborhood and 43 lives in the worst landslide disaster in U.S. history, Jessica Zonka made a promise to herself, to her bereft parents, and also to her late sister, who was buried along with two young sons, her husband, and in-laws. Zonka, as spelled P-S-Z-O-N-K-A, would see a permanent memorial created where relatives and visitors could feel her sister's presence and reflect on the serenity that drew the family to Oso, as well as the forces that left an immense scar in the forested Cascade Mountain foothills along the North Fork of the Stillaguamish River, 55 miles northeast of Seattle. 10 years later, that memorial is complete, and Zonka is leaving. She put her home up for sale and is moving with her parents to Texas. I need to get them out of here, she said. They cannot snap out of it. It's like it happened yesterday, every day, when they drive by the school that the kids would have gone to, she said. The trauma that engulfed Oso, a rural community of a couple hundred residents, on March 22, 2014, was a national wake-up call about the dangers of landslides. Washington State began hiring more staff and conducting more mapping to get a better handle on the risk, and it tightened guidelines on logging landslide-prone slopes amid concerns that clear-cutting near the top of the scar might have helped cause the disaster. Congress in 2020 adopted the National Landslides Preparedness Act to create a national strategy to identify, understand, and protect against landslides. Legislation pushed by lawmakers from Washington State, including Democratic Representative Susan DelBene, D-E-L-B-E-N-E is how it's spelled. It was really hard for anyone to imagine how enormous the impact was, that you really had to be there to see that this side of a mountain collapsed into the valley and up the other side, wiping out an entire community, she said. I personally wanted to do anything I could to make sure that a natural disaster like this did not become another national tragedy, she said. Nevertheless, landslides are likely to afflict more and more people as climate change intensifies storms and wildfires, destabilizing soil. Predicting slides remains difficult, though some research projects have helped establish under what conditions certain types might occur. In the years since Oso, post, wildfire landslides have become alarmingly frequent in California, where mudslides killed 23 people and destroyed hundreds of homes in Monticello in 2018. More than 500 mudslides were recorded in Los Angeles alone after torrential downpours early this year. Another destroyed a home last week. Areas that have not burned have also suffered, such as the mountainous temperate rainforest of southeast Alaska, which has seen three deadly landslides on saturated slopes since 2015. The most recent killed six people in Wrangell in November. Landslides occur throughout the U.S., including in the southeast after hurricanes. But Brian Collins, a research civil engineer with the U.S. Geological Survey, who helped study the Oso slide, noted that in the steeper terrain of the western U.S. and Alaska, they do tend to be, and, as we're seeing, there have been certainly a number of devastating landslides in the past 10 years. None more so than Oso. It was 10:37 on a Sunday-Saturday morning following weeks of heavy rain when the hillside gave way in a scraping, crashing roar. Some residents thought it was the Navy jets that had often fly overhead. Some 19 million tons of sand and ancient glacial deposits, enough to cover 700 football fields, 10 feet deep, raced across the river at an average speed of 40 miles per hour, hydroplaning on the saturated valley floor, kind of like an air hockey table, Collins said. The tsunami of sodden earth and pulverized timber slammed into Steelhead Haven, a subdivision of 35 homes. The highway running alongside was buried 20 feet deep. There had been a history of landslides on the slope, including massive prehistoric slides, and technical reports had warned about a potential large catastrophic failure. But even those reports did not suggest anything could happen on the order of what did occur. Residents said they had no idea of the danger. Homes continued being built even after the 2006 slide. Washington State and the company that logged above the slope paid more than $70 million to settle lawsuits by the 2014 slide's victims and their families. It was the deadliest landslide in U.S. history, according to the National Science Foundation-backed geotechnical team that reviewed it. Nine people survived, including a mother and a baby who were reunited in a hospital 2 weeks later. Tim Ward lost his wife of 37 years, Brandy, and four of his five dogs. He described regaining consciousness 500 yards from where his house once stood, in a hole 15 feet deep, with an opening at the top the size of a kitchen saucer. Rescuers eventually pulled him out. In an extraordinary effort, teams that included 900 responders from near and far, plus volunteers, firefighters and police, military members and local loggers, helped find every victim, often slogging through what they came to call the pile as rain fell. They would silence their chainsaws and other machinery whenever they discovered bodies. The last victim turned up that July, about 3 months after the official search ended. Here's a story from page three, federal spending. Congress has $1.2 trillion plan. Lawmakers have until midnight today to pass budget measure. As I read this, I don't know if that's happened yet, but at this point, Dateline is Washington. It's an Associated Press article. So, as of this point, lawmakers introduced a $1.2 trillion spending package Thursday that sets the stage for avoiding a partial government shutdown for several key federal agencies this weekend and allows Congress, nearly 6 months into the budget year, to complete its work funding the government through September. Democrats were able to swat back scores of policy mandates and some of the steeper budget cuts that the House Republicans sought to impose on non-defense programs, though House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican, Louisiana, highlighted some wins, including a nearly 24% increase in detention beds for migrants awaiting their immigration proceedings or removal from the country. This year's spending bills were divided into two packages. First one cleared Congress 2 weeks ago, just hours before a shutdown deadline for the agencies funded through the bills. Now Congress is focused on the second, larger package, which includes about $886 billion for the Defense Department, a more than 3% increase from last year's levels. The 1,012-page bill also funds the Departments of Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, Labor, and others. Congress must now race to pass this package before government funding runs out this Friday, that is today, that's an end quote now, said Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, New York. Again, that was a quote from Representative Schumer. Non-defense spending will be relatively flat compared with the prior year, though some agencies, such as the Environmental Protection Agency, are taking a hit and many agencies will not see their budgets keep up with inflation. When combining the two packages, discretionary spending for the budget year will come to about $1.66 trillion. That does not include programs such as Social Security and Medicare and financing the country's rising debt. The House is expected to take up the measure on Friday, today. House Majority Leader Steve Scalise urged fellow Republicans to vote for the measure, noting that more than 70% of the spending goes to defense. At a time when the world's on fire, more than ever, we need to make sure that we are properly funding our nation's defense and supporting our troops, Scalise, Republican for Louisiana, said. Then it would move to the Senate, where senators would have to agree on taking it up expeditiously to avoid a partial shutdown. Johnson described the bill as a serious commitment to strengthening national defense while expanding support for those serving in the military. The bill provides for a 5.2% pay increase for service members. Here are some short, brief national updates. New York prosecutors urged the judge Thursday to start Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial on April 15, saying the defense's calls for further delays or dismissal of the case because of a last-minute evidence dump were a red herring. The U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said Thursday that a Texas law giving state authorities the power to arrest and deport migrants who entered the U.S. illegally is unconstitutional, and appeals court put the law on hold for now. Russia fired 31 missiles at the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, before dawn Thursday. Air defenses shot down all missiles, but falling wreckage damaged apartment buildings and injured 13 people, officials said. And Jeffrey Sable, S-A-B-O-L, 54, of Colorado, who helped other rioters drag a police officer into a mob storming the U.S. Capitol on January 6 of 2021, was sentenced Thursday to more than 5 years in prison in the riot. Next article is about U.S. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey. He said Thursday he will not run in the Democratic primary as he faces federal charges in an alleged bribery scheme, but left open the possibility he would run as an independent if exonerated. And here's the final story on Boeing. The heads of leading U.S. airlines want to meet with Boeing and hear the aircraft manufacturer's strategy for fixing quality control problems that gained attention since a panel blew out of a jetliner in January, people familiar with the situation said Thursday. GOP is seeking testimony on Department of Justice Hunter Biden probe. House Republicans filed a lawsuit Thursday seeking to force two Justice Department lawyers to testify about the criminal investigation of Hunter Biden as part of the chamber's impeachment inquiry into his father, President Joe Biden, that has produced no hard evidence of presidential wrongdoing. The Republican-led House Judiciary Committee wants the court to order two Justice Department Tax Division attorneys to comply with subpoenas demanding they answer questions about Hunter Biden. The lawsuit says their failure to testify is impeding the panel's inquiry into claims that the Justice Department mishandled and slow-walked the investigation into the president's son. The department previously said it took extraordinary steps to answer concerns about the probe, including first-of-its-kind testimony from the special counsel overseeing the Hunter Biden prosecutions on gun and tax charges. Still reporting on page 3, headline, Brink Blinken, Rafah would be a mistake. U.S. House Speaker says he'll invite Netanyahu to speak to Congress. This is written by Matthew Lee of the Associated Press. Dateline is Cairo. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Thursday a major Israeli ground assault on the southern Gaza town, Rafah, would be a mistake and unnecessary to defeating Hamas, underscoring the further souring of relations between the United States and Israel. Blinken, on his sixth urgent Mideast mission since the war began, spoke after huddling with top Arab diplomats in Cairo for discussions over efforts for a ceasefire and over ideas for Gaza's post-conflict future. He said an immediate sustained ceasefire with the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas was urgently needed, and that gaps were narrowing in indirect negotiations that U.S., Egypt, and Qatar have spent weeks mediating. Blinken will head to Israel on Friday, today, to meet Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his war cabinet. The growing disagreements between Netanyahu and President Joe Biden over the war will likely overshadow the talks, particularly over Netanyahu's determination to launch a ground assault on Rafah, where more than a million Palestinians have sought refuge. Netanyahu has said that without an invasion of Rafah, Israel can't achieve its goal of destroying the Hamas military group. Netanyahu, on a video call with GOP senators Wednesday, pledged to ignore warnings about a Rafah operation. As Blinken and the Arab ministers met, Gaza's health ministry raised the territory's death toll to nearly 32,000 Palestinians since the war began in October. Meanwhile, House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, said Thursday he plans to invite Netanyahu to address Congress, a show of support from Republicans amid growing Democratic criticism of Netanyahu's leadership. Republicans have rallied around Netanyahu since Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, New York, called for new elections in Israel on the Senate floor last week. Schumer, who is Jewish and a strong supporter of Israel, said he believes that the prime minister has lost his way and is an obstacle to peace in the region amid the growing crisis in Gaza. Johnson said Wednesday that he had a lengthy conversation with the prime minister and reiterated to him the House Republicans' strong support for Israel in their efforts. Moving into the sports section of the paper, men's NCAA tournament, kind of a wrap-up here and what's going on. And the first headline here is Oakland delivers first true shock. It says Jack Golke made 10 three-pointers and 14th-seeded Oakland delivered the first true shock of this year's March Madness, beating third-seeded Kentucky 80-76 in the first round of the NCAA tournament on Thursday night. The Grizzlies, 24-11, sent the Wildcats, 23-10, to another early March exit behind Golke, a graduate transfer who finished with 32 points and some late shot making by his teammates. Trey Townsend had 17 points for the Horizon League champions. DQ Cole added 12, including a three from the corner with 28 seconds left that gave the Grizzlies a four-point lead. Antonio Reeves led Kentucky with 27 points, Trey Mitchell added 14. Bob Dillingham scored 10, but the Wildcats and their roster stacked with NBA prospects spent most of the night trying and failing to chase down Golke. The 6'3" guard who came to the Grizzlies this season after playing for Division II Hillside College made 10 of 20 three-point attempts, 7 in the first half. His only other points came after he was fouled while attempting a three. And in the East, here's kind of a rundown of what happened. Number 11, Duquesne, was 71. BYU, number 6, 67. We go down here to Iowa. Number 2, Iowa State, got 82 points. And 15th-ranked South Dakota State, 65. Iowa State, 1. And we go to Illinois, who's seeded number 3. They got 85. And Morehead State, ranked seeded 14, 69. Washington State, 66, over Drake, 61. That's a bummer for the Drake fans. West, Michigan State, 69, over Mississippi State with 51. Arizona, 85, and Long Beach State, 65. North Carolina, 90, and Wagner, 72. Dayton, 63. Nevada, 60. That was a close one. Midwest, we're in the Midwest now. Creighton, 77. Akron, 60. And we go to Texas, 56. And Colorado State, 44. Oregon, 87. South Carolina, 73. Gonzaga, 86 over at McNeese State, 65. And Tennessee, 83 over St. Peter's at 49. Kansas was 93 points over at Samford, 89 points. And in the South, we go to Oakland, had 80. Kentucky had 76. And we end up with North Carolina State, 80. Texas Tech, 67. So coming up on today, or rather, well, there are many more games coming up today and the rest of the weekend, so I don't have those where I can tell you where they are, but I'm sure you turn on the tube and you want to listen to a game, you're probably going to find it. Folks, you are listening to the Mason City Globe-Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we're going to turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger and the lead story on the top of that page today, Friday, March 22. The headline says, A Safe Place to Recover. CFR dedicates second recovery house for women. It's written by Bill Shea. And it reads, and there's a picture here it says, Mary Wild Center of Fort Dodge prepares to snip the green ribbon Thursday afternoon to mark the debut of a community and family resources. That picture might be with something else. I might take that back. Let me go ahead and read this story. The old brick house on South 17th Street was the site of many triumphs as the women living within it worked to overcome their addictions and live independently. It will soon be the site of similar triumphs and growth, but it will have a different name. Once known as Gateway to Discovery, it is now the Serenity House. It is one of three women's recovery houses in Fort Dodge operated by Community and Family Resources. Mary Wild knows firsthand the importance of such places. And yes, that was a picture of Mary Wild on the front page here. She's cutting a ribbon to mark the debut of Community and Family Resources. The house will be the home for up to 9 women at a time who are competing their treatment for substance abuse. Nice picture, nice color picture, a lot of people. She lived in Gateway to Discovery for 2 years. Now clean and sober for 6 years after decades of addiction, the Fort Dodge resident summed up her recovery for those who gathered Thursday for a ribbon cutting to dedicate the Serenity House. Having a safe place to live for the first couple years of my sobriety was so important, she said. She said, moving into Gateway to Discovery was one of the best decisions I ever made in my life. The Serenity House is the second women's recovery house. Community and Family Resources has opened within the last year, according to Michelle De La Riva, the executive director of CFR. The organization now has 3 such houses for women and 2 for men. She said CFR is really growing in that area of recovery, which is exciting for us. We cannot thank the community enough for welcoming us, she said. And speaking on behalf of the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance ambassadors, Matt Johnson said, The life-changing work that will happen in this house is what helps to make our community great. Living in the Serenity House or any of the other CFR recovery houses is the final phase of the substance abuse treatment process at CFR. De La Riva said people start in a residential treatment program at the CFR facility on Avenue M West. That treatment lasts 30 to 45 days. Then they move into a halfway house for 6 to 9 months. In the halfway house, there is still regular treatment programming. After the halfway house, people can live in a recovery house for 1 year. De La Riva said they are expected to work full-time, and if they're not working full-time, they are to be volunteering. We want them doing something, she said. No CFR staff members live in the recovery houses, but a case manager visits regularly to check on the residents. The Serenity House will receive its first residents in a couple of weeks, according to De La Riva, and she said up to 9 women will live there. The house is at 701 South 17th Street, and it was built in 1920. Next article on the front page, by the numbers, it says. It's been nearly 6 months since Webster City went live with its speed cameras. How's that going? And it's written by Jane Curtis. Webster City is the dateline. Call them automated traffic control devices if you want, but the 4 cameras on the south fringes of Webster City pretty much monitor one thing, speed. To the drivers who pay the citations, they are all about money. If you blast past the speed cameras installed last fall on U.S. Highway 20 and Iowa Highway 17 going 11 miles per hour or more over the speed limit, you're going to get a surprise in the mail. And it's an unhappy surprise. How unhappy? Webster City has pocketed $555,887 since the cameras went live in November. Its take is roughly 2/3 of the gross amount the speed cameras generate for the city and the firm that operates the cameras, Sensys, S-E-N-S-Y-S, Gatso Group, or Gatso. Gatso's take during that same time period is more than $250,000. It takes maybe 12 Webster City Police Department hours each week to perform its role in the speed camera citation process, according to Police Chief Shadow Mork. Honestly, I've been afraid to estimate it, he said. 3 Webster City police officers, one of them the chief, combed through the traffic camera information, confirming violations that deserve citations. Anything that triggers a camera goes straight to the Gatso company in Massachusetts, and they take the video and those shots from the cameras, get the license plate information, and then they have access to the databases to find out who the car belongs to, he said. Sensys Gatso Group calls itself the leading global provider of, quote, traffic safety solutions delivering systems, software, and services primarily for automated traffic enforcement, end quote. That's according to its website, and it's based in Sweden. Once Gatso makes sure license plates match a vehicle, the company sends the information to the Webster City Police Department. They then confirm the identity of the vehicle and that there was a speed violation. Then, Mork said, it goes back to the company and then they send out the citation. It takes about 2 weeks from the click of the camera to the moment WCPD processes the information, he said. The day he explained this, Mork showed that more than 1,000 citations were awaiting WCPD approval. In all honesty, calls for service come first for us, he said, so that's why we have 1,000 to 1,100 backlog, because we've been busy doing everything else. It's a time-consuming process. They claim that if you do enough, you can do 15 seconds per violation. If you are one person and that's all you do, maybe. If you're going through the process of looking at 3 photographs and confirming everything, that's not 15 seconds, he said. Back in 2023, when the topic of automated traffic control devices were discussed by the City Council of Webster City, Mork was asked for his thoughts. I was on record as saying if the purpose of the cameras is for safety, I'm all for it, he said. If it's strictly to generate revenue, I don't like it. One thing is for certain, it is generating revenue. Of the $199,458 gross from 1,853 paid citations dated December 26, 2023 to January 11, 2024, Gatso, after some minor adjustments, earned $64,855. Webster City got $134,318. The enforcement camera revenue goes into a line item in the general fund created by the city's finance director, Dodie Wolfgram, especially for the speed camera revenue. That line, when this story was written, was $555,887. Citation money is remitted to the city twice a month. When the City Council of Webster City agreed to the GATSO contract, it talked about using the income for public safety. Mork said some of it is earmarked for a new police cruiser. But at the time of her interview, Wolfgram said the money had not yet been spent. Now for some bad news. We've been called names, money stealers, personal attack on the officers, threat of civil lawsuits against the officers that approved the tickets, and then the comments that, "I will never come to your town again, will never spend the time in your town again," Mork said. People call, they will send nasty emails, they will send nasty letters not only to the police department, but to City Hall, he said. The minimum fine for a traffic camera citation is $105. That fine goes up with the vehicle's speed. "I know we have had 100 miles an hour on Highway 20, Mork said, and we've had 80 miles an hour on Highway 17. Though costly, the citation for speed through the camera system doesn't go against a driver's license, and it doesn't get reported to insurance, Mork said. The system hinges on people voluntarily paying, so there's really not a whole lot we can do about it, he said. But there's one thing about speed cameras. People have very strong opinions of them, Mork said. But the bottom line is speeding. You know, we've had people that have complained that while I had my cruise control set at 10 over, there's no way I was going 11 over. But you knowingly were going 10 over the speed limit. That's not much of a defense, he said. The city has a 5-year contract with GATSO. Should the Iowa legislature vote to approve the current bill that seeks to disallow automated traffic control devices in the state, that could mean they would have to be removed. In the meantime, the cameras are clicking. Still on page one, here's an article. Grassley, Ernst moved to stop SBA lending plan. The senators say government should not compete with banks, written by Bill Shea. U.S. Senators Charles Grassley and Joni Ernst are moving to stop what they say is a Biden administration plan that would put a federal agency in competition with banks and credit unions for loan customers. The Republican senators from Iowa said President Joe Biden has proposed making the U.S. Small Business Administration into a kind of direct lender in a move that would force financial institutions to compete with the government. "The government doesn't need to get involved where the private sector suffices," Grassley said in a written statement. Grassley, Ernst, and Senators Tim Scott, a Republican of South Carolina, and John Kennedy, Republican of Louisiana, have introduced the Protecting Access to Credit for Small Business Act, which would make it illegal to have the Small Business Administration become such a lender. "Our bill ensures small businesses and local lenders can continue their work without the government's heavy hand in the way," Grassley said. Ernst added, "The SBA has repeatedly shown that it is incapable of running a direct loan program without millions in subsidies from the American taxpayer," she said. The owner of a Fort Dodge business is endorsing the legislation. "As a business owner deeply invested in the success of small enterprises, I fully support this legislation as it is a crucial step in safeguarding the integrity and efficiency of lending for small businesses," Dave Cassens, owner of R&J Material Handling, said in a statement issued by the senators. "Let's empower local lenders to drive economic growth rather than relying on government bureaucracy prone to efficiency," Cassens said. He continued, "I feel as though this legislation ensures that entrepreneurs can continue to access vital financial resources through trusted community institutions," end quote. The legislation is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association, American Bankers Association, Consumer Bankers Association, Independent Community Bankers of America, Bank Policy Institute, and America's credit unions. The bill awaits action by Senate committees. Returning to obituaries now in today's paper, there are a few. Won't read everything about them, but try to get most of it in. David Gord from Eagle Grove, the son of Carl and Angie Bromley Gord, was born June 6, 1946 in Fort Dodge. He grew up in the Thor and Eagle Grove area and graduated from Eagle Grove High School with the class of 1964. On November 14, 1969, he was united in marriage with Linda Middleton. They lived most of their lives in Eagle Grove, where he worked for Mid-American Energy for many years. He was a member of Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Eagle Grove. He enjoyed collecting all sorts of treasures and could often be seen at auctions around the area. Dave's favorite times were spent with the family. Dave passed away Thursday, March 21, after a courageous battle with cancer at Paula Baber Hospice Home in Fort Dodge, at the age of 77. He was preceded in death by his parents and graduation and grandson, Noah James Zerati. Massive Christian burial will be 2 p.m. on Monday, March 25, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Eagle Grove. Visitation will be from 3 to 5 p.m. on Sunday, with a rosary at 2:30 p.m. at Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove. Burial will be in Calvary Cemetery in Eagle Grove. And for more information, foustfh.com. Margaret Breuer, B-R-O-E-R, 87, passed away peacefully Friday, March 15th. She was surrounded by family. Celebration of life is planned for her on Saturday, April 27th at 11 at First Presbyterian Church, Fort Dodge, with a lunch to follow. Arrangements have been entrusted to Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Mark Blair, Peyton. Mark Donald Blair, age 62, of Peyton, died March 21st, 2024, at his home surrounded by his loving family. His funeral will be 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, March 27, at Zion Lutheran Church in Gowrie. Burial will follow at Lost Grove Cemetery in Harcourt. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, March 26, where family will visit with friends at Zion Lutheran Church, Gowrie. Palmer Funeral Home, Gowrie, is serving the family. Elizabeth, spelled A-L-I-Z-A-B-E-T-H, in quotes, A-L-I Davis, Ali Davis, Iowa City, 30 years old, died unexpectedly March 19 at her apartment in Iowa City. Ali was planning on graduating in May with a Master's of Public Health and Master's of Hospital Administration. She had completed coursework, earning a degree of jurisprudence degree. Her undergraduate degrees include double major in English and linguistics with a minor in anthropology. She also earned a certificate in nonfiction writing and a certificate in teaching English as a second language. She loved learning and was a brilliant student. While at the University of Iowa, she was a resident assistant and an intern at the Iowa Youth Writing Project. Allie's commitment to social justice prompted her to volunteer as an advocate with the Rape Victim Advocacy Program, RVAP, and she served as an intern at the Federal Public Defender's Office in Cedar Rapids. She also worked as a resident specialist at Aspire Graduate Student Housing. During the pandemic, Ali taught English as a second language virtually to students in Chicago, in China. She taught English as a second language virtually to students in China. And she was passionate about reading, books, collecting rocks, crystals, and anything else she fancied. Ali was her extended family's go-to person for information on genetics and ancestry research. Ali was born February 19, 1994, in Fort Dodge. She grew up on an acreage near Fort Dodge that she always called home. She attended St. Edmund for elementary and high school, graduation in 2011, an accomplished vocalist, and she enjoyed music and played the saxophone and clarinet in band and jazz band in high school, as well as playing the piano. She loved hiking in the mountains on family vacations and skiing. When she was a baby, Ali had a star named for her. She loved learning teaching and sharing, her star twinkles bright. Allie was, and always will be, dearly loved by her parents, Dr. Larry and Diane Davis of Fort Dodge, her sister Jody Jordison of Waukee, her grandmother Evelyn Delanoit, and her Mamie, Beverly Pingle, who cared for Allie as a child and remained connected to her into child adulthood, plus lots of loving aunts, uncles, and cousins, and her best buddy, Kevakon Cordia. Celebration of Life will be held at Loftus-Water Seaver's Funeral Home on Monday, March 25th, from 10 to 12 p.m., with a time of sharing of memories at 12 p.m., and all at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be sent to RVAP, 108 River Street, Iowa City, Iowa, 52246, or online at rvap.uioWA.edu/support/RVAP. Mary Snoshaug is spelled K-N-O-S-H-A-U-G, Snoshaug, Clarion. Her funeral is 10:30 a.m. Monday, March 25, at Ewing Funeral Home in Clarion. Visitation is 4 to 6 p.m. Sunday, March 24, at Ewing Funeral Home in Clarion. And finally, we have Susan Daisy, Rockwell City, 10:30 a.m. Monday, Spirit of Hope Church, Rockwell City. Services will be visitation 4 to 6 p.m. Sunday at Loftuswater, Palmer and Swank Funeral Home, LoftusweilerFuneralHome.com for more information. Sports section, Drake meets Colorado. The Drake women's basketball team will be traveling to Manhattan, Kansas for a date with the Colorado Buffaloes on Friday. Action begins at 6 p.m. That's today, of course. Action will begin at 6 p.m. and it'll be televised on ESPNN. Bulldogs are representing the Missouri Valley Conference in the NCAA tournament after capturing both the league's regular season and tournament titles. Drake women's basketball was slotted as number 12 seed in the Albany 2 region and will face off against the number 5 seed Buffaloes. The Bulldogs repeated as MVC tournament champs with a dramatic 76-75 win against the Missouri State Lady Bears in the conference championship matchup. The recently crowned MVC Women's Player of the Year, Katie Dinnebier scored 17 points for the night, along with senior Grace Berg's 16. The leading Bulldog of the game was Anna Miller, who matched a career high with 25 points, two of which came on her buzzer-beating layup to put Drake in front as time expired. Dinnebier and Grace Berg were honored as first-team All-MVC selections, while Miller earned second-team recognition. The MVC Defensive Player of the Year Award and the MVC Scholar Athlete of the Year Award. Buffaloes come into tournament play with a 22-9 overall record and an 11-7 mark in the Pac-12 conference play. The Bulldogs came up short in their conference tournament to now number 3 seed Oregon State in a double overtime thriller. Despite stumbling into the postseason with 4 losses in their last 6 contests, the at-large selection boasts some impressive early season wins. Jumping around a little bit in the sports section, here's an article, Dedicated Group Leads Gales, and it's written by Dana Becker. It says, for St. Edmund head girls track and field coach C.J. Tracy, finding different ways to describe his current roster is difficult, but that is a good thing. Tracy has nearly 20 athletes among the 4 grade levels, led by a quartet of senior regulars. Drive, Tracy said. I just can't say enough about the drive they all have as a team. And that all starts with the seniors, he said. Seniors Andy Barwin, Hannah Landwehr, Michaela Leiting, and Reese Lemberg bring big meat experience with them, as all 4 have been involved in state track, cross-country, and cheerleading. I hope I pronounced those correctly. Juniors Jose and Josie Harvey, Sasha Hess, and Ellie Knox, along with sophomores Faith Sherburn, Brianna Satoff, and Anna Lursen all ran on the blue oval last year inside Drake Stadium. The Gales add in Fort Dodge senior high state qualifier Maria Myers to the throwing events. It's just a very competitive, very driven group that is a lot of fun to coach, Tracy said. Honestly, we are just the cheerleaders for them. They are the ones out there working hard and competing, she said. Lursen was 10th in the Class 1A 400 at state last year and also was the anchor on the 4x400 that finished 13th in prelims. Knox, Landwehr, and Les Hess completed that unit with Sherbin, Hess, Sanoff, and Lursen running the 16th place spring medley relay. Harvey advanced in the 100 hurdles with a time of 16.98, leading Knox. Lander and Lursen ran the 4x800. Myers, meanwhile, was a double qualifier in 4A, placing third in the discus and 13th in the shot put. It's very nice to add her to the team, Tracy said. Going into meets knowing that we are going to score points in the field events is an added bonus. We've had girls compete there in the past and some points here or there, but Mariah is going to really be a big addition. St. Edmund opened the season with a handful of indoor events, led by a pair of third-place finishes from Lursen and Myers. We had a lot of girls running during the winter sports season, Tracy said. We had a lot of girls running over spring break. I just love the fact that they are putting up time and effort to be the best they can be. And the older girls have done an excellent job of leading by example. For the newcomers, everybody is just pushing each other and supporting each other. It's a close-knit group who has goals they want to accomplish, she said. Rounding out the roster will be sophomore Maggie Flaherty and Addison Schmitz, along with freshman Lily Eslick, McKenna Caveo, Alex Leeting, Myra Lemon, Sophia Schleins, and Abby Toffelin. Tracy will once again be assisted by Mike Landwehr. St. Edmund opens the outdoor season on Saturday in Algona for the CYO. They will run at the Dodger Relays on April 18. And folks, going to give you a little rundown here of television and what's on for the games. There's a lot of things going on, for guys' sakes, and a lot of different stations. For instance, FS1 has a NASCAR Craftsman Truck Series qualifying Circuit of the Americas, Austin, Texas, 2:30 p.m. today. NASCAR Xfinity Series qualifying Circuit of the Americas, Austin, Texas, at 4:30. ESPN News, Formula One practice. Melbourne Grand Prix Circuit, Albert Park, Australia, if that's of interest to you. College baseball, if that's of interest. ACCN, Florida State at Clemson. FS1, West Virginia at Oklahoma. This is at 7 p.m. tonight. SCCN, Florida at LSU. 9 p.m., Pac-12N, Southern Cal at UCLA. And now we're college basketball men's, another rundown. Oh, let's see here. 12:45 today, TNT NCAA tournament, UAB versus San Diego State, first round. 1 p.m., TBS in the NCAA tournament, West men's basketball, West Kentucky versus Marquette. It's the 1:45 CBS on CBS NCAA tournament. Stetson versus UConn, first round. 2:10 p.m., True, TRU-TV, in NCAA tournament, New Mexico versus Clemson in the first round. And jumping over now to the women's NCAA tournament, Maryland versus Iowa State, first round. That's at 6:30 p.m., and that will be on ESPN2. And then it goes on 7 p.m., you could watch the tournament to Eastern Washington at Oregon State, first round ESPNU, but I'm guessing if you're watching the Iowa State game, you're not going to change off of that, so you might want to pass that one up. But that's a kind of an idea of what's going on. There's a lot of sports, a lot of stations to watch. A couple things you might be interested in on this date, national, March 22, 1969, Lou Alcindor scores 37 points to lead UCLA to the NCAA men's basketball title with a 97-72 win over Purdue. Alcindor is chosen as MVP for the third straight year. And 1969, West Chester State beats Western Carolina 65-39 to win the first women's collegiate national championship. The game is played using the six-player format. Well, folks, I think that's about going to bring us to the end of today's reading. Friday, March 22 of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm your reader and have been your reader, Doug Kretzinger. I want to thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, and I hope you have a great day.